Indeed, it is, along with Nick Begich, our guest. So we'll be back in a moment as we continue to talk about mind control. I'd like to find out what is it about the brain that makes this happen on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, what is it about the brain that allows it to be controlled so with all these different techniques?
Well, essentially, the brain can be influenced by external means. You know, we always think about, you know, chemicals, and this is where the MK Ultra projects got all its notoriety from the LSD and the hallucinogenics that they were messing around with and using mainly on American servicemen and women, which is the saddest story in all of this, because, you know, these folks can't go to their congressmen like you and I can and issue complaints. For that, you get in, you know, you don't have that privilege in the military. And so, you know, again, you know, who are the victims of this kind of technology? They tend to be the people that are the least able to control the outcomes in their lives. Military become often that case. When you look at sort of where does it go and how can you do this? Again, several different methods. And let's kind of go through a couple of these. We talked about this idea of entraining the brain or making the brain mirror an external signal. What they found, and this is what Persinger was saying on the Undercurrent segment, he was saying, look, you can, you know, modulate a signal that creates these various brain states where the brain will lock onto that very faint signal, but it's in this range where the brain understands it. The brain begins to mirror it, begins to copy it, to mimic that signal. As soon as it does that, it creates a chemical cascade. All the chemical reactions that normally go along with those brain states began to manifest, and you're there, whether it's highly agitated or stressed, because we're not talking in this instance of voice transfer. Mm-hmm. We're talking about changing the general condition of the person in terms of their mental state, and the brain being the guidance system for the entire body, you then have that effect. So you're affecting people emotionally. You also can affect them physically. By physically altering what happens within the brain that controls various functions of the body. On a more gross level, using pulsed microwave systems, you can actually create such confusion that you can't think clearly, you can't focus, you can't draw your attention to the things that you need to draw your attention to. And again, for weapons applications, you know, we can all kind of see that. You know, there was a Scottish media report that came out after the first Gulf War from Bush Sr. And after that was over with, there was this article that said, hey, you know, what they used out there was a technology where they embedded signals on the radio broadcast going into the battlefield that broadcast the Muslim music and prayers that all of our adversaries were listening to every day. Mm-hmm. And on those signals, we carried in one that would create this agitated, fear, panic kind of sense. And what did we see? You know, we saw the fourth largest army in the world collapse like kids on their first fire drill in an elementary school. You know, and the reality is, when you consider that, you know, would these technologies be used and you know, we just before the break we were talking about the Iraq situation to pacify a population. Would they utilize this there? And my answer is absolutely yes. In fact, I would suspect that what we'll see in the coming months, as things get worse and deteriorate, that new technologies will be introduced and openly talked about as being good for regaining stability in these regions of the world. The thing that is missing in all of this, again, is the open discussion about what do these systems do, how do they work. The idea of that Persinger and others have mentioned. In fact, one of the real interesting guys on the Undercurrent segment was a guy named Smirnov out of the Psychocorrection Institute in the Soviet Union, or what it used to be, and now associated with the Russian Academy of Sciences.
He's not the vodka Smirnov.
No. And this guy developed a technique where he could actually embed signals on radio broadcasts or on white noise, carry it up through any of the systems within, you know, our modern technological world, and carry a signal in that would affect people. And he demonstrated on this video segment and talked about the idea of being able to do this for creating like a signal that went up to the ground floors and the upper floors of this building they were working in, giving everyone the suggestion to bring them cake. And the deal was, you know, in Russia, this is something traditionally done. You know, when you have tea, you have these little cakes or cookies. And so it's not something so unusual, but by the end of a 24-hour period, they had workmen on the street, they had coworkers in the offices above, all bringing them cake on a signal that nobody consciously could hear.
That is amazing. You know, you just said white noise, and it reminds me of the Michael Keaton movie about the EVPs, the electronic voice phenomena from ghosts.
Yeah.
Is it possible that some of these recordings that people are picking up when they go do their ghost hunting might be transmissions from some of these very bizarre sources, not ghosts?
Could be. I'm a pretty open-minded about all of this because I think there's, you know, what we don't understand today is our lack of understanding of the scientific principles behind it. And I think when you talk about perceiving, you know, things from other realities, you know, is it possible? I think there's enough evidence out there anecdotally to say, hey, something's going on. Let's figure out what it is. The idea of electromagnetic fields being able or possible to trigger these kinds of things are being used. You know, could you pick up a signal of, you know, someone that's disembodied? I don't know the answer to that. I think it's an interesting question. I think that that's one that maybe technology will develop. You know, when you go back to Edison's day, he was very interested in this. You know, Edison and all the guys back in that era, that was the middle of the greatest inventions in the world. You know, Tesla was doing his work. Edison was doing his work. They were fighting with each other. But all these ideas were openly discussed. They weren't ridiculed. And they were considered valid science of the day. And, you know, seeing film come out today, fictionalized film, taking some of those ideas, you know, a lot of fiction film is developed based on scientific principles. That's what makes it interesting. That's what makes it good. We've consulted for filmmakers in the past where they wanted just an understanding of what technology would look like visually so that they could, you know, depict it properly in film. So, you know, a lot of this stuff gets to the, you know, crosses to the edge, but I can tell you this, creativity all flows from the same place. Some of it manifests in film and some of it is an invention, but ultimately, I would say with some level of confidence that just about anything that a human being can conceive, you can pretty much create. If you're, you know, dogmatic in your approach to getting it done, these technologies and the understanding of the human brain and how to affect the brain has been central to many people's research for both positive applications and military applications. Because ultimately, I mean, some of the darker side of the things that we've talked about, you know, the idea of creating illusions, the idea of creating images that are so real you think they're real. What does that do to the rules of evidence in court proceedings in 30 years? You know, what does that do to other things where we rely on people's word and what they saw or thought they saw as evidentiary?
We're going to have different court reporters, that's for sure.
Well, we have to have a whole different understanding of how to create proofs that are absolute. And again, this is where people start to get very concerned, you know, not only the idea of should we even be doing this? I mean, from my perspective, the answer is, from an external perspective, no. You know, if you were an individual saying, hey, I've got things that I want to do with my own brain to enhance my performance or to get rid of certain problems or what have you, that's a whole different matter. But it would be almost the same, in fact, it is the same, as the initiatives that are being put forward today about drugging major populations in terms of young children with Ritalin. You know, I mean, we see that today. Is that mind control? Sure it is.
Absolutely.
And it's to get people to conform to a certain standard that society has decided is the standard, what we used to call adolescence.
Now, there are some who actually believe that the prescribing of, that they're doing the right thing. There's no doubt about that. Doctors and parents and everything else.
Well, let me give you an example of this. Is a very good one for because it's on topic. We're talking about Ritalin as a mind control substance or other pharmaceuticals. You know, brain biofeedback, something I know you're familiar with,
yes.
Which is the idea of taking a brain and basically hooking up with EEGs,
mm-hmm.
And then you look at a screen. Like for little kids, they use like a bouncing ball or a running race so that the child tries to make the person run faster or the ball to bounce higher. And now they have these really cool helmets that don't have all the electrodes and the goo that you can wear on your head, and kids kind of like them. Minneapolis School District set up a charter school several years ago taking kids on Ritalin and psychoactive drugs that were hyperactive or attention deficit disordered, and were able to work with them for 30 to 40 sessions, 1 hour each, using this apparatus, and teach the children how to moderate their brain activity on their own. without anything to assist them. In other words, like riding a bicycle. You know, when you get on it, you ride it so many times, you never forget it, even if you never pick one up for 20 years. The same thing was happening here. They were laying out neural pathways. At the end of the first year, 80% of the student population were off of all psychoactive drugs and were being reintroduced back into regular education classrooms. Now, that is a profound and positive application of this kind of knowledge that is developing, unfortunately, much too often by militaries under cloaks of secrecy. And here you have a situation that is proven. Now you have other school districts in the region, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and other places around the country duplicating that program for several reasons. First of all, for the kid, it's obvious. It's a life-changing event for the child. For the taxpayer, everybody else who lives in those communities, it's a huge savings because it costs 2 to 3 times as much per year for 12 to 13 years of public education from kindergarten through 12th grade that you can avoid by a one-time expense of training a kid to operate their brain in the way that it was all absolutely intended to operate so they can function without chemicals, without these agents that destroy liver and kidneys and create other problems down the road.
Nick, your two-part series here, Mind Control and Technologies in the 21st Century, the DVD series. Now, this is the first one. This is not a how-to mind control, is it?
No, what it is it's really it's broken into two sections. The first is discussing sort of the dark side of where this technology is, and the second side you might consider a how-to, because what we discuss there is light and sound technologies, electrocranial stimulation, electroacupuncture. We talk about sound wave technology related to transferring infrasound directly to the brain. And we demonstrate it on film where you actually go through close in looking at each of these applications and how these things are used for instance, light and sound devices. They're used for accelerated learning applications. They're used for meditation, for relaxation, and for elevating your energy levels during the course of the day by just using light and sound as the medium. And these are things that you can actually see in blood chemistry changes. Those have been documented. There's a couple of essays that we've actually reproduced that get into some of that. But these are technologies that are applied for enhancing human performance that are controlled by individuals, not imposed on us. And I think that's the difference. I mean, when you look at these big initiatives for pharmaceuticals, for schools, you know, that they're talking about again, you know, this is something that came up, you know, almost 10 years ago, during the first Bush administration, Bush Sr., where they wanted to do a $400 million initiative and go into inner city schools, evaluate students based on them acting out. You know, and the same basic characteristics of acting out in a criminal way are the exact same acting outs that leaders display. It's just a question of routing it in a proper way. So kids that may be non-conforming tend to be the ones that are leaders in all of the areas that we're concerned about, whether it's the arts or the sciences or business or politics. And we're actually suppressing these characteristics rather than recognizing for what they are, because a lot of folks within classroom environments just don't like dealing with the conflict. A lot of parents are working 2 and 3 jobs and defer to the health practitioner rather than understanding that kids go through a lot of stuff as young children. And medicating them should not be the first option. It should be the last option.
Where do we stand with these implantable technologies?
The implantable technologies are interesting. There was one of the first public documents that I would consider public was the U.S. Army War College document published in 1989 called The Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War, where they discussed using implant technologies for GPS, for geographic positioning system, for locating people on the planet. And this was the idea that you could implant this under the skin and then special forces engaged in combat, you know, we would know where they were and be able to track their movements. It also mentioned in the article that this might be handy for business travelers because after all, it's a volatile world. And if something happens, you know, they want to be able to find our citizens is what they were saying. But what they also said back in 1989 was that this technology, along with many others discussed in that paper, would never be accepted by the American public unless there was an environment of fear created. And they proposed in 1989 that environment of fear could best be created by major concern on international terrorism and international drug trafficking. And if you look at the PSAs, the public service announcements produced by our government today, they tie those two issues together because it's all part of that outline for how do you get new technologies introduced, and it was create that environment of fear. And just do a simple comparison, terrorism as a threat to the average American. You know, if you add up all the people that died of terrorist events in the United States in the last 15 years, from Oklahoma City to New York, and just assuming that all
as
of them,
tragic as they are
and horrible, and I feel for everyone involved in all of that. But when you compare it, there's about 5,000 people, a huge number for sure, and families. I can't overstate how devastating that has to have been. And having lost my father in a tragedy, I totally identify with it. But compare it to medical malpractice, which in 15 years, according to Harvard University, killed 1.5 million Americans. Now, which is the bigger problem?
Oh, and what about plain murders, where you get 25,000 murders a year in this country times, let's say, 10? That's 250,000 people.
Yep.
Gone.
Yep. Yep.
No, I understand.
Right.
It's strange, Nick, when you look at the things that are unfolding, how the episodes that have occurred over the last few years, and I've got my own thoughts and reasons for them, have affected this plan for control in all forms and fashions. It's everywhere.
Yep.
Now, this story I led tonight with is one of the most, as a journalist who has spent all his life in the media, to see a prosecutor recommend to a judge that reporters go to jail because they don't want to reveal their confidential sources in this country is sickening to me.
Yeah. You know, and it's people have asked me, you know, over the years, one thing that I've not done and I refuse to do is ever touch a classified document. And people say, well, why not? You know, the New York Times does. Well, I don't have 100 lawyers like the New York Times does, you know, number one. And given this most recent decision, I wouldn't do it in 1,000,000 years. And the problem is, you know, the classification of material today. There was an article published recently in terms of the Freedom of Information Act. You know that because of the changes since 9/11, less than 10% of the document flow that used to flow under the Freedom of Information Act flows today. 90% is constrained, not released anymore.
Or blacked out when you get it.
Yep.
I mean, Stanton Friedman gets all this stuff on UFOs, and 90% of the FOIA documents he gets, they're all blacked out.
Right. You know, and when you look at all of that and you consider it, there's got to be, and this is something that we were working on in Europe back during the HARP fight. You know, we had introduced this last clause into the resolution deliberately, this issue of manipulation of human beings. And the reason we did it was we spent months strategizing how to bring forward the non-lethal aspects in these more invasive technologies. Well, right after that resolution passed, with a lot of objection, I can tell you, from the United States, they did not want these sections in there. The individual responsible was the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, a guy named Tom Spencer. Within days of this resolution passing, his political career was over. And the next step that we were going to take together was to try and create, through the European Parliament and European institutions, an international whistleblower mechanism that would apply not just to government employees, as many of them do, but would extend out beyond that to the corporate world and develop a methodology for people to be able to blow the whistle on their corporate employers or government employers when human interests are being sacrificed for either corporate or governmental interests. And I think that's something that the world needs today. I think we need an institution that can do that, that people can trust. And we have to have the right to be able to stand up as individuals and recognize that our governments don't always work in our best interest. It's something our founding fathers certainly understood in this country, and something the average person has forgotten or only periodically remembers. And I think we have to hold our governments accountable. And the way we do that is by a little more open disclosure, not less of it. You know, Watergate happened because of a lack of disclosure. You know, we're hearing a lot about whether the guy was a villain or a saint. Well, I remember those days. And it was the Nixon administration, you know, that was responsible, I believe, for the loss of my father. And I have some strong feelings about what has never been disclosed from those days. And I can tell you, our government is in need of serious reform, and openness is the first step in that direction.
And again, Nick Begich's father was a United States congressman who died in a plane crash, and he had been spotted They had spotted bodies, probably alive at the time, and nobody ever went to get them. They never found the bodies, as a matter of fact. We'll be back in a moment. I'm going to open up the fast blasts for questions for Nick Begich. So I'll go through them if you want to do that. And then we'll have the phone lines opened up at the top of the hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, let's go to some fast blasts for the rest of this half hour. Henry from Sun Valley, California, wants to know what China might be doing in this area of mind control.
Well, I think that's a good question. And the idea of China being involved in this kind of research is I think, pretty fundamental. You know, the idea of you know, my background is an alternative complementary medicines, Chinese medicines, Asian medicine in terms of the philosophy basically starts in energy and goes up from there. Western medicine starts at the body and goes down to chemicals and body compounds, but generally doesn't go much deeper than that. There's a profound understanding in terms of how the body is regulated by energy fields in China, and that has to play into their weapons development. When you talk about Chinese military development, you know, their budget is estimated by our Central Intelligence Agency at about $40 billion a year, which is approximately 10% of the United States military budget, which people kind of then say, well, China's not really a threat. It is, because when you talk about a $40 billion budget in terms of what it buys in China versus a $40 billion budget and what it buys in the United States, we're not talking about $1,500 hammers and toilet seats.
No, not at all.
We're talking about technicians being paid minimum dollars compared to anything comparable in the West. The ability of being able to move forward faster in China in these areas, I think, is absolute. If you read the Senate intelligence reports on China, which I have read many of them, what you see in China is a 30 to 40 year model in terms of how do you take on your adversary. And don't forget for a moment that the West is considered an ideological adversary of China. And what they have done is a very classic Sun Tzu move. And it's the art of war. What they've done is they're using our strength against us by creating the biggest capitalistic state in terms of trade in the world. But what are they doing to the rest of the global economies as a result? They're building up huge cash dollars and cash reserves. They're changing oil prices globally because of their energy demands and demand for refined products. If you really look at the Chinese strategy, it's about crippling the West over the long haul, while in the interim using the West to build up their own internal industries. Same thing the Soviets did during the Cold War.
It's like a consultant. He will borrow your watch to tell you the time.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, with the Chinese government, you know, I mean, people will say, oh, but free trade is so good. You know, it's changing the attitudes of people. In China, the attitude of the average person doesn't matter, because the Chinese government doesn't acknowledge individuals as valid. You know, they acknowledge the population as serving a greater purpose, and that purpose they believe should be spread throughout the world, in much the same way that ideologically Westerners believe that our philosophy should be spread out into the world. The thing is, we all use our technologies to further that political end. When you look at strong states nationally and internationally today, what makes a state strong or a government strong? It's their command of technology.
Sure.
The higher the technology, the more powerful the government. And in a democratic republic such as ours, that means that it's absolutely imperative that the average citizen have an understanding of these technologies. Doesn't mean we have to know how to, you know, how they all operate any more than we know how to fix our cars today. But we ought to be able to have the discussion, and we ought to be able to drive the policy in the directions that line up with our values and aren't forgotten for some value that maybe we don't really understand, nor do we appreciate.
This weekend on video, I watched The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. And you know what? They were pretty tough warriors in their battle against their government at the time. Except when we came in, we gave them Gatling guns.
Right.
And they mowed down everybody. I mean,
right.
And that's what changed the direction in its technology.
Right. And, you know, what you're talking about is the essence of what's called today the Revolution Military Affairs, or the RMA, by our military. And it's a change in technology that they equate to the introduction of gunpowder, for instance, as one example. The other was the introduction of atomic weapons in the last century. And what they've essentially said is, look, what we're on the threshold of today and in the middle of today is a revolution that is going to change, profoundly change warfare and war fighting. And what we're talking about is not getting away from the bullets and the bombs and getting geared towards the idea of energy as the medium for whether we're affecting hardware or computer systems or human beings. And this is where the real thrust of the sciences are pressing forward. When you think about energy-based weapons, you're talking about weapons that travel at the speeds of light, 186,300 miles per second, compared to conventional warheads at their optimum, at their absolute optimum, traveling 30,000 miles an hour.
Tim, go ahead.
So huge, huge differences when you talk about energy warfare versus bombs, bullets, and the things of that are really quickly relegating to the past.
Tim from Los Angeles wants to know if there's any way to prevent our five senses and eventually our brain from being manipulated electronically.
This is a question that always gets asked, and here's the problem, is there is no single system that can counteract all of these effects that we have found so far. It doesn't mean that there might not be something out there, because our government, I'm sure, has developed countermeasures, because whenever you develop new weapons, it's the countermeasures that become even more important. In fact, even subject to greater classification, because if you can avoid the problem. Now, with directed energy weapons like a microwave, if a microwave is directed at you, a metal mesh screen grounded to ground will dissipate a signal, you know, if it's because of the wavelength of the signal. But if you were using, say, the power grid to carry a signal in, or radio broadcast to carry a signal in, no, there's nothing out there that's, you know, available readily and easily that would solve the problem. The Morrises, who had worked in the Reagan-Bush administration, were proponents for some of this research, also were proponents for the idea of putting, instead of a V-chip on your electronic apparatuses, putting on a chip that actually screened out these kinds of signals so that it couldn't enter your environment. Mm. And I think that's a great idea, but first it requires acknowledgement by the average person that this technology exists, and the demands by the average person that our privacy and our individuality be protected as paramount, at least within this country, should be considered paramount. I mean, freedom to think presupposes the idea of freedom of speech, religion, assembly, and freedom of the press all require first and fundamentally the freedom of knowing our minds are operating independently and freely. And this is something I think absolutely in this country should be protected. And any violation should be criminal. People should be going to jail for violating the rights of human beings without their consent for this kind of experimentation. And they aren't. People need to be not indemnified by being public servants, but made public servants and held fully accountable for what they do.
Which leads us to this writer from New Mexico who wants to know if ordinary people with dissenting opinions sometimes are subject to mind control.
I think if you go back to the CIA's work back in the 70s, there was a report that came out in 1975, and it was a congressional investigation by a presidential committee on the CIA. And what the CIA had done then, and now they're doing with permission because of this Homeland Security evolution, is they were engaged in domestic surveillance. They were surveying all of the congressional leadership, was monitored by CIA and FBI during the Hoover administration and the FBI. You had student groups infiltrated and interfered with by Central Intelligence Agency. You had mail open by organizations from organizations all over the country, again by Central Intelligence, supposedly for our own safety. You know, all of these things have happened in the past, and I believe continue to happen today with much more sophistication. If you look at the NSA capability in terms of monitoring, and we've talked about that in the past on the program, you know, they're capable of taking in vast amounts of information and interpreting that information in ways that provide incredible levels of intelligence. As computing power continues to increase at the rate that it's increasing, we're going to see the merger of human interactions and computers to the point where virtually there is the potential of no privacy at all. That's something to consider. No privacy at all. That's where the technology takes us if we allow it to just continue to progress without regulation.
Because if you're able to pelt things into the brain, might you one day be able to extract information from someone?
Yeah, you know, this is interesting. This is it is an exciting area in one sense. I mean, where they talk about in the one particular document, Low Intensity Conflicts in Modern Technology, they talk about this issue of, you know, wouldn't it be great to be able to create a complete memory set, like a foreign language, for instance, and just download it straight into the brain to where, you know, instead of years of work.
It's done. You're already there. Yeah.
And that is not an unachievable goal. There are many, many researchers around the world that believe that's obtainable.
Or play the piano or something.
Exactly. Now, if you think about it, there's a couple concerns here. Firstly, is when you dump information into the brain, in most of the methods that have been developed thus far, you bypass the conscious, the part that filters out right and wrong, good and evil. And as a consequence, what you end up with is a direct feed, as Smirnov in Russia said, it was as if you were hearing a commandment from God. It cannot be disobeyed, is what he said.
Hmm.
It's so compelling. So you think about it, now it becomes very important to know what the input is. I mean, if you want to get a foreign language, that's pretty neutral. You're going to learn a bunch of words and some vocabulary and syntax and things. But what about social studies, you know, or history, or, you know, a lot of other subjects that people have fundamental disagreements on? And what happens in an environment of compulsory education that we have in the United States, where you're required as a matter of law to be in a public education system that's giving you a publicly developed curriculum that's developing that into your child's education platform, and in 30 years, maybe that platform is a download that takes place in a few days.
What if somebody puts something in software that you would think, for example, you're going to learn a language, and you do, but they've also downloaded something to say, vote for me, or whatever.
Exactly right. And you remember, even during remember that first Bush election of George Jr., when he used subliminals in one of his ads? He used the word rats buried into a Democratic slam ad.
Yes.
And he got caught, and he withdrew it, so it was a mistake. It was no mistake. If you look at the most sophisticated advertising, if you look at the canter of the sound, if you look at the flicker rate coming off of the television screen, all of these principles are well understood. And if they're applied in development of advertising, you can create highly suggestive states in individuals, and there's no regulation about this. I mean, the subliminals using word phrases was regulated back in the late 50s when they were doing it in movie theaters to get you to buy more soft drinks and popcorn and stuff. You know, and today you can do it by just the flickering of a light in a specific pattern that make you more susceptible to the suggestion being played out in the advertising.
Wasn't there also audio that they used to pipe in, which, you know, would might say something like, buy, or something like that, if they wanted you to buy something?
Yeah, they have that. In fact, there's a patent. We cited in the book Earth Rising and Revolution, or maybe it was Earth Rising 2, but it was a patent that was developed for dissuading. They use it the opposite way, theoretically, to dissuade shoplifters in Japan, and where they installed this, and it was on the, you know, that little elevator music that they play in department stores, in the background, below the auditory level of perception, where you could understand what was being said, in seven languages, they were making statements to dissuade shoplifters. It had a 40% reduction in shoplifting.
Interesting.
In those departments.
That is fascinating.
Now
that's used for good, then.
Well, unless they want to get rid of their old inventory and they start putting that on there, and there's no regulation about that.
Right. I mean, there's got to be some good with this technology, don't you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, you know, it's like a truck. It can deliver your mail or it can deliver the mail bomb. Depends on the operator. And this is, again, where regulation comes into play, is if you're developing these technologies openly in a way that enhances human performance, that solves problems, I'm all for it. I mean, brain biofeedback that we mentioned earlier is a prime example of it. You know, that's not just used for children. It's used for stroke recovery victims that have lost mental capacity. It's used for, you know, for alcoholism and drug addictions with some success, in fact, very good success. And there's practitioners of that all over the country right now. And unfortunately, it's not something that's made it into the mainstream of education where it could be even more effective. But again, these are technologies that can either serve us or enslave us. And it really depends upon what the intent of the operators are. In the area of the brain and what goes on within the brain, or manipulation of human beings in any kind of artificial way, I think we need to look at that in the same way that the world has looked at chemical and biological treaties, and it looked at lasers for blinding. You know, it's not permitted as a valid way to wage war. And I think mind control technologies should be relegated to the exact same place because, quite frankly, it is the most invasive. And the reality is these technologies are being developed and will be turned on Americans just as easily and readily as they will on our adversaries because there's no regulations to say they can't. And there's every motivation to do it.
Will, then, from Salt Lake City, wants to know if you've ever read Dean Koontz's book called Night Chills about a government's subliminal mind control experiment on a very unsuspecting town.
No, I've never read that book, but you know, I can tell you the scenario wouldn't surprise me. You know, but you know, whether it be a town or individuals, you know, individuals have been targeted by our government in gross experiments over four decades. And you know, again, you know, why isn't there an outcry over that? I mean, 500,000 people. I mean, that is a lot of casualties in a war that nobody knew was being
waged.
Well,
let me ask you this: is it accurate to say our government did this?
Yes.
Isn't it more accurate to say that some people within government, operating under black ops projects, do this?
Yeah, I would have to say, George, that would be a much more accurate.
Yeah,
because it's not an open, acknowledged agenda.
Right.
It's an agenda held by a few that unfortunately have the power to execute it.
Exactly. And taint it for the good people who are in government, who are trying to do the best they can.
Yeah, and you know, these guys aren't sitting around going, you know, what can I do to hurt people? I mean, even these guys, I don't believe, are doing that. I think what they're doing is thinking, okay, what can we do? And from their, you know, paranoid view of the world as government, you know, functionaries, you know, they're guarding against every horrible nightmare that they can perceive. And so they're utilizing technology they believe will achieve a political end. And unfortunately, you can't achieve political ends if you sacrifice the values that you're trying to save. And that's the mistakes that get made, is we are sacrificing the fundamental values that we're supposed to be protecting in exchange for what? You know, is that safety? Is that security? It's not the safety and security I want, and not the safety and security most people in this country want. We want an open government, a transparent government, and what we're getting is the opposite. At the same time that the government is becoming more opaque, more difficult to look into, the average person is becoming increasingly transparent. This is the ultimate step in that transparency, and that violates every fundamental principle of decency and individual integrity that most of us across the planet hold in common.
How do you shield against some of this?
You know, again, you know, our approach has always been, you start, you know, developing technologies to counteract this is not going to be the answer. The answer is politically to solve the problem so they can't utilize this technology in an unreasonable or unacceptable way. And so I think the first step in all of this has been public education. You know, we've talked to victims around the country over the years and tried to figure out, you know, who's who. And the one thing that we can say to all of those folks out there is focus your time on educating the public on technology. If you can lay the issue of being a victim aside for long enough to do that, the average person will gradually gain the knowledge to know that these technologies exist. In the same way that when you talk about a laser today, there's very few people who don't know what a laser is. There's very few of those people that know what a laser is and know how to build one. But they can, you know, they can tell you a little bit about them. You know,
sure.
Most elementary school kids can today. If 50 years ago somebody had come into a room with a hole perfectly burned through their shoulder and said, "Oh, a beam of light hit me and burned this hole in my shoulder," nobody would have believed them. Today, the first response would have been, "That's a laser." The first step in dealing with mind control technologies is getting the public to recognize through the evidence and through education that it exists. And that's really the Lay Institute on Technologies. That is their mission. And that is my mission for the next 5 years as executive director of the Institute, to make sure these issues and this particular issue gets that kind of public awareness.
All right. Stay with us, because now we'll open up the phone lines. Your turn with Nick Begich right here on Coast to Coast AM.